Our next sponsor is Podcorn. Podcorn is a marketplace that connects podcasters with great sponsorship opportunities like host-read ads, interview segments, topical discussions, and more. Podcorn takes out the middleman so podcasters of all levels have a chance to monetize their podcasts, setting their own rates and having full control over their collaborations.
We started using Podcorn a few months ago and it's already changed the game. We can actually make some money from podcasting, which means we can put more time into doing what we love and trying to produce quality content. I found the site so easy to use, podcorn.com. You'll find the link in our show notes. It really is easy to navigate and you can view loads of different sponsorship opportunities right there on your screen. It couldn't be easier to pitch a proposal to a brand to work with them on a campaign. Podcorn makes sure podcasters are able to keep their creative freedom and have full control over how and when we monetize. They also have automated payment, which means you get your money as soon as you've submitted your work. If you're a fellow podcast host, definitely check out their site, podcorn.com.
She was not alive when you left. The children were not alive when you left.
Welcome to Crimelapse. I am Eileen.
And I'm Charlie.
When society portrays the perfect family life, it usually includes working a well-paid job that you enjoy, raising a family with someone that loves you, living in a house in a nice neighbourhood, having a circle of close friends. The Coleman family seemed to fit this description pretty well, at least to those on the other side of the door. This is Sins, the Coleman family murders.
Early on the morning of May 5th, 2009, on a suburban street in Columbia, Illinois, Detective Sergeant Justin Barlow was awoken by a panicked phone call from his neighbour, Chris Coleman. Chris asked Detective Barlow to check on his wife and kids as he was rushing home from the gym and would be another few minutes. Detective Barlow knew that Chris had received threatening emails and letters before, and so he called the Columbia Police Station to ask for assistance performing a welfare check on Sherry Coleman in the house across the street. Detective Barlow tried ringing the doorbell, but it went unanswered. Then, Officer Jason Donjon was dispatched to the location. The officers walked around the house where they found an open window. The screen of the window had been taken off and was lying up against some garden furniture. Worried by the silence inside, they identified themselves as law enforcement before climbing through the basement window. As they got to the first floor, they heard the garage door open. It was Chris Coleman arriving home. Barlow told Chris to wait outside, as he, Officer Donjon, and another Columbia police officer Patton searched the home. There was a potent smell of paint. The walls had been sprayed with red spray paint, obscenities and malicious phrases, things like bitch, and I am always watching. As they ascended the stairs, Officer Donjon saw a woman's naked body lying face down on a bed in the bedroom on his left. She was identified as Sherry Coleman, Chris's wife. The officer found no pulse or signs of life. Sherry felt stiff. It was clear that she was dead. As the officer rolled her over, he saw that her chest looked as though it had been deeply bruised. Her blood had pooled there because of the position her body had been lying in. Officer Donjon went into another bedroom and found 11-year-old Garrett Coleman dead in his bed. Circles had been spray-painted on his bedroom wall, and there was some on his hand and arm. Detective Barlow had gone into the other child's bedroom where he found 9-year-old Gavin Coleman's body covered in a sheet. He was dead. The words, "fuck you," had been crudely sprayed on the sheet that covered the young boy's body. Chris Coleman, the homeowner and now sole surviving member of the family, was heard calling out to the officers from downstairs. So Detective Barlow brought him outside where he told him that his family were gone. Chris began to cry and sat on a curb in front of his house. Officer Patton stood next to Chris as he rang work and his father. Officer Patton had been to the residence before, in early January of that year. A threatening letter had been received by the Colemans that stated, "Fuck you. Deny your God publicly or else. No more opportunities. Time is running out for you and your family. Have a good time in India, motherfucker." Chris Coleman was a bodyguard for a renowned televangelist, Joyce Meyer. He'd been receiving threatening communications regarding his work with Joyce, and on that May morning, he said he was worried for his family when he couldn't get in contact with his wife after he had taken a quick trip to the gym. Chris's neighbour, Detective Barlow, knew about the threats and had offered to help the family out. So that is who Chris called to check on his family when he couldn't get in touch with them that morning. Chris and Sherry Coleman met in 1997. Sherry Weiss was in the military police with the United States Air Force, and dog handler Chris caught her eye at a canine training centre in San Antonio. Chris was quiet and gentle and seemed to perfectly contrast her wilder personality. She impressed most people that she met. They began a relationship almost immediately. In August of 1997, after just 3 months of dating, the pair discovered they were expecting a baby, and days later, without any friends or family by their side, or even being aware, the young lovers got married. Sherry had been introduced to Chris's parents just the night before. He introduced her to them as his friend from Chicago. Chris had grown up as the son of a preacher. Both of his parents, Ron and Connie Coleman, were co-pastors of the Grace Church in Chester, Illinois. They delivered messages from Scripture weekly to the congregation. They preached clear teachings from the Bible. It was a guided path that Chris and his brothers were expected to follow. Sherry didn't fit the expectation that some people had for Chris's partner, but they loved each other and were starting a family. Sherry and Chris welcomed their son, Garrett Coleman, on the 30th of April 1998, and just under 2 years later, their loving family expanded once more when the turn of the new millennium brought Gavin, born 25th of January 2000. Chris began working for Joyce Meyer Ministries that same year, working as a security manager for the Christian non-profit organisation. Joyce Meyer was a televangelist. She knew the Coleman family well. There was a lot of travel involved, but it paid handsomely. Chris was on a six-figure salary. Sherry devoted her time to their two boys and the church. The family worshipped at Destiny Church in West St. Louis County, and Sherry adored her role within the church. She organized social events and fundraisers mostly by herself. They had decided to raise their family in a house on the lake in quiet suburban Columbia, Illinois. Locals described it as a wonderful place to live and raise a family. Sherry was there for everyone. She recognised her privilege financially and loved to share their good fortune with her loved ones. She spoiled them for birthdays and at Christmas. Sherry even paid to have a friend's entire kitchen remodelled. She was a ray of sunshine to all those blessed enough to know her. The boys, Garrett and Gavin, were polite and respectful young boys, taking after their mum with their hilarious and animated personalities. They played together as brothers do at home and on the field. They both played for respective sports teams, and their dad, Chris, coached them both. Friends described their family as model-worthy. Their home was always welcoming and very clean. Everything was always perfectly in place. With Sherry, the affectionate, laid-back, fun mum, and Chris taking on the role of stern father, ensuring they were disciplined, but the boys adored them both. Despite this, Sherry had expressed to her friends how she felt as if Chris's family had never really accepted her. They would still make the trip from Columbia to Chester, Illinois to see Ron and Connie. Chris often had to promise Sherry a trip to her favourite restaurant in exchange for her enduring awkward visits to his parents' home. Sherry was a giver. She'd buy food and blankets for the homeless and drive relentlessly around St. Louis, Illinois, delivering them. Meanwhile, Chris had told friends that he had become tired of his job. He spoke of how the Meyer family could click their fingers and he would have to go running, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. It took him away from his family a lot and it was becoming too much. Sherry grew weary of her husband leaving constantly, and the strain began to show on their marriage. In early 2008, the two confided in friends that their marriage was struggling. Chris complained to his friend and neighbour, Chris Bootler, about his shotgun marriage and how he worked 80 to 90 hours a week. He discussed the possibility of not wanting to continue his marriage to Sherry, but how he was worried that he might lose his job. He had heard of others being fired for divorcing their partners. He wasn't happy, but he told his friend that he just didn't know what to do. Money was an issue also. Chris loved having the money and the lifestyle that it afforded the family, but he didn't like the way that Sherry chose to spend their money. He would say to her in front of friends, "Oh, chill out, you holy roller." In the fall of 2008, Chris spoke with Vanessa Redirex, a neighbour of the Colemans and fiancée of his friend Chris Butler. He appeared angry and banged his fist on the kitchen counter, exclaiming, "I'm going to divorce her." He explained that he was going to wait until after Christmas and the celebrating was over. Sherry had her suspicioned, following hints dropped by Chris. And in December, she texted Larry Bridges, a youth pastor at Destiny. The text said, "Things got way worse with Chris and I'm so disgusted I don't even know where to go with it. I'm not giving up on my marriage. I love Chris way too much. This seems like a horrible dream." Chris began to tell people that he felt God had a plan for his life and Sherry was keeping him from God's destiny. Sherry had told multiple friends how Chris had told her to her face that her and the kids were simply in the way. In November 2008, Chris was due to fly to Florida with Joyce and JMM for a conference. At the same time, the family received a worrying email from the email address destroychris@gmail.com. It read, "If I can't get to Joyce, then I will get to someone close to her. And if I can't get to him, then I will kill his wife and kids. I know Joyce's schedule, so I know Chris's schedule. During the Houston conference, I will kill them all as they sleep. If I don't hit there, then I will kill them during the book tour or the trip to India. I know where he lives, and I know they are alone." Chris had been receiving threats, and it seemed as though working for Joyce had put a target on his back. She was disliked by thousands in America, so the threats weren't taken hugely seriously, but they kept coming. Chris had shared his feelings of marital unhappiness with his boss Joyce, who recommended the couple attend marriage counselling sessions with JMM pastor Mike Shepherd. Sherry had also confided in friends that her and Chris were rarely intimate. In January 2009, she told her friend Christine that Chris had said to her during sex that she wasn't to assume that it meant that he loved her. Sherry had expressed how the act of sex itself had been a rare occurrence, and then when they had been intimate together, he'd said those words, and also told her to shut up and turn over. She'd unveiled these quiet details to her friend, adding, "He's not very affectionate to me, so I'll take whatever I can get." Neighbours Chris and Vanessa were close with the couple, and their kids played together. On one occasion, the couples were together, and the conversation steered towards sex. Chris publicly announced that he couldn't even remember the last time they'd had sex. Vanessa then ordered the pair to go home for some alone time. She said the boys could sleep over at their house, and sent the Colemans home with a marital goodie bag. They had been seeing Mike Shepherd for counselling, but Chris had appeared cold and distant during these sessions. Sherry had revealed to Joyce Meyer's son, Daniel, that Chris wasn't participating fully in the sessions, and Daniel warned Chris that if he didn't adjust his attitude and have a willingness to work through this, they'd reassign him to another position. Sherry's phone sprung to life and the familiar tune of Lucky by Jason Mraz rang out. The hit song with the lyrics, "Lucky I'm in love with my best friend," was her ringtone for Chris. Sherry answered and was met with a furious Chris. He was so mad that she'd gone to Daniel, and begrudgingly, he then participated in counselling with the ministry pastor.
The Colemans' marital problems were about to take a back seat, as on the 2nd of January, the family received a threatening letter in the mail, a letter much scarier than the priors. It read, "I'm giving you the last warning. You have not listened to me and you've not changed your ways. I have warned you to stop travelling and to stop carrying on with this fake religious life of stealing people's money. You think you are so special to do what you do, protecting. or think that you are protecting her. She is a bitch and not worth doing it. Stop today or else. I know your schedule. You can't hide from me forever. I'm always watching. I know when you leave in the morning, and I know when you stay home. I saw you leave this morning. I will be watching. You better stop traveling and doing what you are doing. This is my last warning. Your worst nightmare is about to happen. Daniel Mayer, CEO of JMM's US operations, was distraught to hear of the threats being made to Chris and his family as a result of working for his mother. He quickly offered extra security for the Coleman's house, especially for when Chris was working away. He also offered for Chris to halt travelling for a while to protect his family. Chris denied both options. Detective Patton of Columbia Police Station attended the house to investigate the letter that had been found. Officers canvassed the neighbourhood, asking if anyone knew anything. Detective Justin Barlow lived across from the Colemans. The letter they had received worried him, and he reached out to a friend of his at Illinois State Police and arranged for a camera to be fitted in his 5-year-old child's bedroom. This window had a direct view of the Colemans' mailbox, so that if any further correspondence was received, they'd have video proof. The camera was fitted on April 28th. Barlow let the Colemans know that he had fitted the camera and that he was available if they needed anything. Early on the morning of the 5th of May at 6:43 a.m., Chris contacted Detective Sergeant Justin Barlow from a gym in South County, Missouri. He said that he had been trying to call Sherry to make sure that the kids were up, but he was unable to get a hold of her, and he had a horrible feeling that something had happened. He explained that he was coming over the Jefferson Barracks Bridge from Missouri to Illinois, which meant that he was only about 5 minutes away. Following all the threats they'd received, he was on high alert. Barlow called to the police station for assistance and started to get ready. Once he got to the house, it was 6:51 a.m. He knocked on the door and rang the bell with no answer. As he turned on his heels to begin an inspection of the outside of the property, his colleague, Jason Donjon, from the Columbia Police Station, pulled up. The two of them walked around the property, looking for an intruder, signs of a break-in, or to try and see Sherry or either of the kids through the window, but they had no luck. Officer Donjon noticed an open window. He then saw the screen for it leaning up against a table and patio chair set. The two officers crawled through the window and identified themselves as police. They found themselves in the basement of the house. Chris Coleman arrived home at 6:56 a.m., 13 minutes after he said he would only be 5 minutes. Inside, they discovered the bodies of Sherry, Garrett and Gavin Coleman. Police Chaplain Reverend Jonathan Peters introduced himself to Chris and accompanied him in the back of the ambulance to the police station. In the ambulance, the chaplain again explained to Chris that his family had died. Chris didn't ask what had happened. He looked down at his arms and saw a number of scratches. "How did they get there?" he exclaimed, referring to the marks, before he began hitting the gurney next to him. Chris Coleman was brought to an interview room at the police station. Detective Barlow and Trooper Dave Bivens of the Illinois State Police listened to Chris as he explained that that morning had been like any other. He had gotten up and left to go to the gym at around 5:40 a.m. He said his family were still sleeping. He said he had later tried to call Sherry to ensure the kids were up and getting ready. When Sherry didn't answer the phone, Chris's concerns escalated and he contacted Officer Barlow. He had told them that when he left, his wife was alive.
Well, I set my alarm clock for 5:30. I'm going to use my phone for my alarm clock. And we have it at 5:30. I'm in the bathroom. Put these clothes here on. And went to the bathroom and basically got in the truck and left. And drove off. I got to where I was at. But I called Sherry to wake her up, get her going. And she didn't answer, of course. But, so I went on to the gym, to Old's gym, over by Ronnie's Plaza in South County, and started working out. I texted her text her at some point. I might even have called her, and I don't remember. I could probably look at my phone if you want me to.
Do you guys have a home phone number too, or just cell phones?
We just use cell phones. So okay. I text her, and then she still didn't respond, and probably now it had to have been well after 6 o'clock sometime when I texted her or called her. I'm sure it's still on her phone the time it was.
Okay.
And she didn't respond. It's not like her because the kids should have been up and stuff, or getting up and going by then, I believe. And so I called her again. Called her again on the way back, or when I was getting ready to leave, and she didn't respond again. And I started getting a little concerned because it's not like her not to answer the phone. Sometimes she won't answer if she's in the shower, but she always calls me back right away. And so she didn't do that at all. And so that's when I called you.
Chris was wearing his gym shorts and a sleeveless top, the outfit he had worn to go to the gym. He kept touching and covering his arms. He brushed his hands over the scratches on his arms and complained aloud that he was cold. An officer left and brought him a blanket that he loosely wrapped around his shoulders and arms. Intense grief washed through the community, reeling from the sudden loss of a valued member and her two boys, whose neighbours frequently passed them playing on the lawn. Dread partnered their sadness as they feared there was a crazed killer among them. The house was cordoned off with tape as forensic technicians processed the grisly scene inside. Deborah Von Nida, supervisory investigator with the coroner's office, arrived at the scene at 10:57 a.m. and entered the home. She needed to take the temperatures in the rooms that the bodies were found in. The ambient temperature is the temperature of the air surrounding a component. In this case, it's the bodies of the deceased. In each room, the ambient temperature was taken and the temperature of the body's core by way of the liver probe. In Sherry's bedroom, the ambient temperature was 76.6 degrees Fahrenheit and her core temperature was 90.4 degrees Fahrenheit. Garrett's room was recorded at an ambient temperature of 75.2 and his core temperature was 91.8. Gavin's temperature was not recorded as long strands of hair and spray paint were present on his body, and this needed to be preserved and untouched for evidence. Forensic pathologist Dr. Raj Nanduri carried out post-mortem examinations on the victims that afternoon. On all three of the decedent's necks, ligature marks were found. The cause of death was marked as ligature strangulation. At the time of the autopsy, the doctor gave a time of death range for approximately 6 to 8 hours before 11 a.m, based on Sherry Coleman's body temperature at that time. This placed the time of death between 3 a.m. and 5 a.m. Lividity was also noticed by those at the scene, which is the pooling of blood in a victim's body after death. The hair that was found on Gavin's body was consistent with Sherry Coleman's hair, indicating that she was strangled first and that her hair was transferred on whatever was used to strangle them. The small town police department weren't equipped to deal with a crime of this magnitude. Police Chief Edwards requested the assistance of Major Jeff Connor and the Major Case Squad of Greater South Louis. Major Connor brought along with him 25 seasoned cops to investigate the death of Sherry, Gavin and Garrett Coleman. Officers asked Chris if he felt like the experts would be able to determine the time someone had died. Of course, Chris said, he had seen it happen on TV. Knowing this, the officers pressed further. Are you sure you're being 100% honest with us? They asked if Sherry was definitely alive when he left the home that morning. He insisted that she was. Or at least he thought she was. They floated the idea that they were not entirely convinced that she was alive when he left home.
We felt very comfortable that we had given you every opportunity to tell us something that was going to contradict the information that we had. Mm-hmm. All right, we've got this information. You're saying it, and we're giving you an opportunity to give us something contrary to what you told us before, so that, okay, yeah, all right, that would make sense. That hasn't happened.
That hasn't happened.
Listen, man, she wasn't alive. When you left.
She was laying right beside me.
Listen to me. We can go back and forth with this all day long, but the physical evidence doesn't lie, man. She was not alive when you left this morning. The children weren't alive when we left this morning.
Yes, they were.
No, come on, Chris. We gotta get over this. Now, there's reasons, and that's the point we're at. I want to hear the reasons. Now is when we need to find out what happened, man. It's so important. You're at a great point to be able to help us to try to figure this out. We already know what happened. We need to know why it happened.
You do
know what to tell us.
No, I don't.
Come on, Chris. She was not alive when you left. The children were not alive when you left. You know that's true, and I know that's true.
No, it's...
We need to clear this up now. We need to clear it up now. Did something happen? What happened? What was going on in your life, Chris? Because I can't buy what you're saying. The physical evidence does not lie, Chris. It does not. She was not alive when you left, period. The physical evidence does not lie, man.
What do you want me to tell you? I'm telling you the truth.
How did we get to this point? That's what I need to know.
Crime scene investigators combed through the house. Experts seized and trawled through the phones, computers, and wider tech of the Coleman family. Chris Coleman did not ask how his family had died. The officers questioning him left the room to give him some breathing space. As they did this, they were informed that the threatening emails that Chris had received in late November 2008 had come from an email address that was set up using a work laptop. This work laptop was assigned to an employee of Joyce Meyer Ministries. The employee was Chris Coleman. On further investigation, they found a plethora of photos and documents, explicit images and videos, all featuring another woman. The images featured naked photos taken as selfies and also taken by Chris. There was also a sex tape of Chris and this woman, and videos of Chris masturbating in the shower, exclaiming, "You are the only person I've ever done this for. I cannot wait to see you in Hawaii. I love you, baby." Officers re-entered the interview room at Coleman and leveled with him, pleading with him to be honest. Was there anything at all he needed to tell the officers? Chris explained the marriage he had with Sherry, the relationship he had, how they'd been having marriage counselling and that it was going pretty awesome.
We kind of talked about the divorce a little bit.
This last December.
Yeah. And I went to Joyce with it, told her about it, or Danny, I can't remember which one. Mm-hmm. And they knew about it, and they suggested that we meet with somebody and see if we could work out whatever it was. And really all it was just communication, not communicating very well. So,
did you meet with somebody?
Yeah, Mike Shepherd, the guy that's here downstairs in the lobby.
Okay.
And we've been meeting with him pretty regularly, and things have been going pretty awesome.
How often do you meet with him? I mean,
he travels overseas a lot too, and so as often as me and him schedule, I'd say on average, maybe once a week.
Oh.
Sergeant Bivens asked Chris if he had been seeing anyone else outside of his wife. "What do you mean?" Chris replied. Bivens continued, in a romantic way, to which Chris denied. He was positively adamant that he wasn't cheating on his wife. The woman in the photos was discovered to be Tara Lintz, a high school friend of Sherry Coleman's. Tara had been called in for questioning at a station local to her in Florida, and had willingly handed over her BlackBerry and laptop, which was flooded with information, photos, emails, notes and messages between her and Chris Coleman. Armed with this information, Detective Barlow re-approached Coleman, who had remained adamant that he was not having an affair. After casually dropping into the conversation that multiple friends of Sherry's had been brought in for questioning, including a friend from Florida, Chris began to falter, saying, "Tara in Florida that you guys are going to talk to, I talked to her a ton lately, but she's just a friend, somebody to talk to." Sergeant Bivens replied, "You said you had a close friendship, but were you actually doing anything that you felt wouldn't be approved by your wife?" Chris admitted that some of the conversations the pair had probably wouldn't have sat well with his wife, but insisted that him and Tara were nothing more than friends. They had met through Sherry at a family vacation in Florida. This version of events wasn't to last very long. Officers in St. Petersburg, Florida, were quickly gathering more and more evidence and immediately feeding it back to the team in St. Louis. The pair of officers interviewing Chris regularly left the room, allowing him to stew on his story, and also giving the team a chance to hear the evidence as a live feed. They discovered that Tara and Chris had met at a JMM conference in November 2008, an event that Tara only attended following a recommendation from her high school friend, Sherry. The pair began a continuous communication from this point on, and a sexual relationship began in December 2008. Just as it had done with Sherry, Chris's relationship with Tara moved fast. They began to tell one another that they loved each other, bought each other promise rings. Chris had a note on his computer with all of Tara's measurements in it, her ring size, and a description of her sexual fantasies. One of the notes was titled 11-5-08, The Day Tara Changed My Life. There was even a note alluding to their future daughter's name, Zoe Lynn Coleman. This didn't sound like a friendship. Chris had travelled around with JMM, meeting up and staying with Tara whenever possible. When Joyce had an event in Florida, he requested to stay on after. His colleagues would return home without him, and he stayed in Florida for extra days with Tara. The pair also met in Hawaii. There they made a sex tape together, which was stored on Chris's computer. Tara explained to officers that Chris had told her that he was serving Sherry with divorce papers on the 4th of May, but a typo had delayed it and he would definitely finalise things on the 5th of May. Then they would be free to start their lives together. They had planned to go on a Caribbean cruise on the 14th of June 2009, and then they would get married in January 2010. Tara had been looking at rings online. She had registered them on a wedding website. She'd even been looking at houses in St. Louis for them to live in together. They even shared bank accounts and credit cards. For all Tara knew, Chris was leaving his wife and kids to start a new life with her. Other friends of the Colemans were interviewed and they all shared the same opinion. They had clearly been fed from the same information. Sherry was upset because Chris had mentioned wanting a divorce, and Chris felt like Sherry was ruining his life. And he was terrified that a divorce would cost him his job at JMM. He expressed this to his friends, who fed that information straight back to the police. By this point, cybercrime investigators had tracked the threatening emails to Chris's work laptop at JMM, but they had also scanned through the documents and emails saved and sent from Chris at work. They compared them to the threatening letters and emails. Time and time again, the same mistakes were made in both. Words such as opportunity and publicly were constantly spelled wrong. It seemed that the affair Chris was having with Tara was a strong motive for murder. But it wasn't enough. After over 6 hours at the station, Chris Coleman was released and he left to stay with his parents. This episode is sponsored by Smile Brilliant. If you're like us, you're confused by all the variations of teeth whitening on the market. But no one wants those Richard Ramirez teeth. Since taking Smile Brilliant on as a sponsor, we've learned a few things that you may find helpful, such as LED lights are a novelty item, strips neglect the gum lines, crevices and molars, charcoal is abrasive and wears down the enamel, and whitening toothpaste only works on surface stains. So what actually works? The number one product recommended by dentists is the custom fitted tray. They are, however, very costly as it requires the dentist to make them by hand using a model of your teeth. With Smile Brilliant's lab direct process, you can have custom fitted teeth whitening trays at a fraction of the price without a single visit to the dentist. Because no one really likes going there anyway, right? Using an exact model of your teeth, Smile Brilliant's lab technicians will handcraft your trays to ensure the best possible results. Simply order the system at smilebrilliant.com using the coupon code TRUECRIME for 30% off. Then make your dental impressions at home and return them to Smile Brilliant using the prepaid envelope provided. In a matter of a week, Smile Brilliant will have your trays back in the mail. You can wear your custom tray while listening to our next episode.
A service was held in memory of Sherry, Gara and Gavin at Reverend Ronald Coleman's Grace Church Ministries on the 9th of May. It was a beautiful service. Friends and family immediately began raising funds to build a memorial for the family, a pavilion to remember the mum and her two boys. Chris was brought back into the station to give further evidence, including fingerprints. The investigating team still had the family's tech in their possession. Subpoenas were sent to AT&T and crucial evidence was being uncovered. Each piece of evidence was like a puzzle piece, and the more pieces they gathered, the clearer the picture became, and it suggested only one suspect. On Tuesday 19th of May, 2 weeks after the murders, officers pulled up to the home of Ron and Connie Coleman in Chester, and Chris was arrested for the murders of his wife and two children. 3 counts of first-degree murder. Chris was transferred to Monroe County Jail and was held there without bond due to go before the judge the next day. Coleman entered the courthouse on the 20th of May and spoke to confirm his name to Judge Stephen Rice, who asked if Coleman understood the charges brought against him, to which he replied, "Yes, sir." Judge Rice advised Coleman that the prosecution will decide if they will be seeking the death penalty and that he will be held without bail until the trial. Before the trial could take place, many motions were filed and pre-trial hearings took place. One of the motions filed was a request for a Frye hearing. A Frye hearing refers to the Frye test. This is a test used in US courts to determine the admissibility of scientific evidence provided by a professional. Essentially, if an expert forms an opinion based off scientific evidence, the scientific technique used to form this opinion must be widely recognized and accepted in the science community. The defense used this test to attempt to bar the testimony of forensic linguistic analyst expert Dr. Robert Leonard. The motion for a Frye hearing was granted and the court closed as follows. The court, after conducting a Frye hearing, rules that the testimony of a linguistic expert may be admitted to the extent of noting similarities between the question documents and the known documents, without presenting an opinion as to authorship by the specific person and similarities between the question documents themselves. A motion was also filed to bar Lindell Moore's testimony. Moore is a handwriting analyst expert who was responsible for determining the similarities between the writing sprayed on the walls and Chris Coleman's handwriting. The defense argued its relevance and the objection was taken under advisement and reserved until the time of Moore's trial testimony. Next up, the defendant filed a motion to bar evidence of the sexual messages exchanged via text and email between Coleman and his girlfriend Tara. This included the photos and videos. The state argued this evidence was relevant to the case. It showed Coleman's motives, it showed the seriousness and extent of his extramarital relationship. The trial court authorised 3 videos to be used at the trial, as long as any nudity was censored. The same was said for a number of still images recovered. Both sides, state and defence, filed motions with regards to the 13 potential witnesses, including those that had all different parts of Sherry's story of Chris wanting a divorce and his feelings of resentment towards his family for holding him back. They were allowed 5 of 13 witnesses, as most were dismissed as hearsay. Exceptions included direct conversations and text messages. However, a text from Sherry to her friend Megan that read Coleman had beat her was to be excluded. Because of how widely reported the case was, jurors had to be selected from Perry County to avoid prejudice in Monroe County. Then finally, on a warm spring day in April 2011, the trial began. In Monroe County Courthouse in Waterloo, Circuit Judge Milton Wharton entered the courthouse that was bursting at the doors. Friends, families, neighbours and press all gathered. People didn't want to believe that it was Chris. They wanted to be there to find out that he hadn't been capable of these horrific acts, so they could take the good news home to their families, that they were safe. And a neighbour that had waved to them in the morning and was known to protect another person's life hadn't killed his wife and sons. Chris sat in a dark grey suit with a tie, clean-shaven and trembling. He entered a plea of not guilty. The state opened and Monroe County State Attorney Chris Reitz explained to the 12-member jury that Chris had grown frustrated. Sherry wouldn't grant him a divorce. His new life with Tara was waiting for him, it was just out of reach, and the hurdle that prevented him from living that life was Sherry. He couldn't believe he couldn't get away from her, Reitz explained. He had a motive for these murders, in that he had the threat of losing his six-figure salary. Employees of JMM had been fired for behaving as he was, but he wanted to start his new life. Defense attorney William Margulis claimed, "There is a lot of reasonable doubt." He described Chris as a wonderful father, very involved with his children. Margulis admitted that yes, Chris did have an affair, but he had committed to marriage counseling with Sherry, and in the weeks leading up to her murder, things had improved and they seemed happy. The court heard testimony from the officers present that morning in regards to Chris Coleman's behaviour and the scene inside his home. Detective Barlow testified that Chris Coleman had initially been cooperative when questioned and voluntary have swab, blood and fingernail samples. But when he had to provide handwriting samples, he said he was tired and couldn't write in cursive. The defense began an attempt to prove reasonable doubt, asking, "What about Chris's brother Keith?" They implied Keith hadn't been as cooperative with the police as maybe he should have been. They suggested that, in recent months, Chris's brother, who'd once stayed regularly at the Colemans, was suddenly no longer welcome to stay. They also described a video sent to Sherry historically by Keith of the brother strangling a deer. The defense knew that a single seed of doubt within the jury could bring the entire case crumbling down. Barlow argued that Keith Coleman had a viable alibi in Arkansas where he lived. Barlow was then questioned regarding suspects. Who were the suspects and how did they come to those names? "We had one," he answered. "It was Chris Coleman." There were over 100 people interviewed over the course of the investigation. Despite Chris Coleman being suspected almost immediately, the case would cost upwards of $1 million. Paramedic Gary Hutchinson also testified. He stated that he arrived at 7:05 a.m. and saw Chris outside crying. Hutchinson testified that all three were confirmed dead at the scene by himself and his colleague Jared Hutch. They concluded that rigor mortis had set in. He explained that, in his experience, most bodies that have rigor mortis have been down for a while. The pair had then driven Chris and the police chaplain to the police station in their ambulance. Jared Hutch had emulated Hutchinson's story. He remembered lifting Gavin's arm to check for rigor mortis and discovered it was present. This was an obvious sign of death, and Hutch therefore concluded that there was no need for CPR or further examination by a paramedic. Graphic images of Sherry and the boys were shown to the court. Judge Wharton gave a prior warning. "I've been instructed that the next group of photographs are pretty rough." As a result of this, many of Sherry's relatives left the courtroom whilst the images were being shown and were escorted back in afterwards. Sherry was shown naked, face down in her bed. Garrett curled up in his bed with traces of red paint on the white bedsheets, and Gavin face down with his arms dangling out from under the white covers, which were spray painted. Chris remained still and didn't look up to see the images as they passed. Dr. Ranj Nanduri, the pathologist that performed all three autopsies, determined that the time of death must have been between the hours of 3 and 5 a.m. It had to be speculation. It was determined based on the liver temperatures taken at the crime scene. The case presented by the prosecution was circumstantial and revolved around determining exactly what time the three of them had died. Defense attorney William Margulis argued that doctor and jury couldn't accurately determine the time of death. Another defense attorney of Coleman's cross-examined doctor and jury and pressed her about this. Dr. Nanduri once again confirmed this time frame was reached through liver probing and was only speculation that she was initially uncomfortable providing. Dr. Barden, former chief medical examiner of New York City, used the autopsies performed by Dr. Nanduri and the photos, findings and reports to base his opinion on. He also concluded that time of death would have been around 3 a.m. that it would have taken them each around 4 to 5 minutes to die, and that the same ligature was used to kill all three of them. He explained how the lividity, which is the pooling of blood in the lower body, meant they could have been dead up to 8 hours before discovery, but the stomach contents indicated that time of death was 3 a.m. Next to testify was Tara Lintz. Tara was 33, she worked as a cocktail waitress in Florida where she lived. When her presence was originally requested at the trial, Tara had unsuccessfully fought against it. She testified for 20 minutes, confirming she had met Chris Coleman at a Joyce Meyer Ministries event in Florida in November 2008. She also explained how she'd only attended this event because her friend Sherry had advised she did. It was there that she bumped into Sherry's husband, Chris Coleman. The pair caught up and began a back-and-forth flirtation. They exchanged numbers and from that day on they communicated constantly. Tara confirmed that their relationship became physical the following month, December 2008. Details of Tara's computer internet search history were read out to the court, including those registering the pair on a wedding registration site and all the homes in St. Louis she'd searched for and saved. Tara confirmed that it was all for her and Chris and how they'd planned a life together. A home, a wedding in 2010. Reitz noticed a ring on Tara's hand and asked her about it. She beamed that it was a promise ring gifted to her by Chris, and he had one from her too. Tara continued that she'd been told by Coleman that he would serve divorce papers to his wife on the 4th of May. He then explained to her they had been pushed back a day because of a typo. This meant that the day that he had promised his mistress he would end his marriage had been the day his wife and kids died. "Yes," she said, confirming it was her and the sex tape from Hawaii, but she couldn't recall being aware that the video actually existed. Nude pictures of Tara were then shown to the court, some taken by Tara herself and some taken by Chris. There was also snippets of a video of Chris in the shower. This video had been sent to Tara and featured him masturbating, saying, "You are the only person I've ever done this for. I cannot wait to see you in Hawaii. I love you, baby." The prosecution announced to the court that they were seeking the death penalty for 3 counts of first-degree murder. Chris's 5.5-hour police tape was played to the court, where he was probed about the state of his family when he left his home that morning. The court heard him justify his relationship with Tara and then go back on himself once the police had received confirmation from Tara. They watched him become confused when asked why the usually 5-minute journey home from where he told Detective Barlow he was took him 13 minutes, especially at a time that he claimed to think his family were in such danger.
Sergeant Michael Grist, a crime scene specialist in the Illinois State Police, testified on the 5th day of the trial about the technical examination of the scene. They had collected 17 exhibits, 9 latent prints of footwear, paint or prints, 100 photographs of the scene, the bed sheets and blood from Sherry's sheet. Columbia Police Detective Carla Hine testified that a can of paint was purchased using the Coleman's credit card from a hardware store. Illinois State Police forensic scientists and chemists from Rust-Oleum tested the spray paint from the walls and positively indicated that it was Rust-Oleum Apple Red. The court were then informed that after trawling through the Coleman's bank statements, they found a small amount of $3.77 paid to a hardware store on February 9, 2009, 3 months before the murders. The police contacted the store for the transaction, and the answer brought an auditory response from the court. "He bought spray paint," the store assistant had told the officer. "Rust-Oleum Apple Red." Lindell Moore was allowed to testify and stated that there were significant similarities between Chris Coleman's writing and the spray-painted messages found on the walls. He could not definitively say it was Chris Coleman that sprayed them, though. Robert Leonard was also permitted to testify. He was a linguistics professor and testified about the similarities in the spray-painted messages and the letters the Colemans had received. The phrasing was similar and also looked like Chris Coleman's handwriting. The defense had attempted to bar this witness and objected to Leonard's testimony on occasion. Defence attorney O'Gara even took the opportunity to ask him if he had ever sampled brown acid when his band played at Woodstock in 1969, referring to the drug LSD. Friends of Sherry testified that she had told them about problems in their marriage, and that Chris had said she was messing up his life. At one point, the jury were instructed to disregard a statement made by a witness that Sherry had texted her to say Chris had beat her. Other witnesses said that Chris had told Sherry that she and the children were keeping him from his destiny. Melody Lavald, a forensic scientist with the Illinois State Police, testified that the hairs found on Gavin's body had come from his mother Sherry, and that there had to have been force used to remove them from her head. Michael L. Brown, also with the Illinois State Police, stated that DNA consistent with Chris Coleman's had been found under Sherry's fingernails, but said that people shed skin cells often and that the DNA may have been the result of casual contact. There was no evidence found that indicated anyone other than a member of the Coleman family was in the house at the time of the crime. There was no sign of forced entry at the basement window either. It was already noted that Chris Coleman had told Detective Barlow that he was 5 minutes away from home when he called him at 6:43 that morning. Testimony from an AT&T cell network employee shed light on his movement that morning, from using his cell phone data to place him at different locations. The first call Chris made at 5:43 a.m. was that he rang Sherry to allegedly wake her and make sure that the children got ready. He called her again 45 minutes later from the gym, and 10 minutes after that along I-270 in St. Louis, the road home. At 6:43, he rang his neighbour, Detective Barlow. This call was placed from the Jefferson Barracks Bridge. 10 minutes later, Chris made another call. This call placed him away from the route he should have been taking home, especially in a hurry. A final call 5 minutes later placed him close to home. An employee from the Major Crime Squad testified that he recovered Chris Coleman's BlackBerry, Dell laptop, Dell desktop computer, and an Apple laptop. He also recovered Tara Lynch's BlackBerry and Sony laptop. He stated that he found a large number of explicit photographs and videos on the phones and laptops. He also noted that in both items written by Chris and the threatening letters he received, the word opportunities was misspelled the same way. The cybercrime investigators arguably provided the most poignant evidence in this case. The proof that the emails from the Destroy Chris Gmail account had been sent from the work laptop assigned to Chris, the one that his boss confirmed he carried everywhere with him. Some emails were even sent using the IP address associated with his home address. The prosecution played a tape of Joyce Meyer's deposition. Here are some extracts from her testimony.
Did he have a company laptop computer?
Yes.
Did he carry it with him?
Yes.
Is this something that you saw with him when you made these trips, for example?
Yes.
He seemed to always have it with him?
Yeah, he carried his computer.
Okay. Did you ever see anybody else use that computer other than the defendant?
No.
Joyce described how she knew Chris from when he was a little boy.
And we'll get right to the point. Do you know the defendant in this case, Christopher Coleman?
Yes, I do.
How long have you known him?
Since he was a little boy.
And how was that?
His parents came to some conferences that I did over in Illinois. I did a weekly meeting over there, and his mother came to it, brought him with him.
Now, at some point, did he become an employee of Joyce Meyer's ministry?
Yes, he did.
And about when was that?
Probably about 1998.
Okay. So, and through 2009, he was with you about 11 years, is
yes.
that correct?
Yeah.
What kind of employee was he? What was his responsibilities there?
He was in the security department.
Was he in general security? Did he move up through the ranks? What happened with that?
If I remember correctly, he started in general security, and then he became the supervisor of that department. And then when a personal security person that I had left our employ, we offered Chris that job, and he took it.
And what did that job entail then? Did he travel with you?
He traveled with us when we did conferences, when we did speaking engagements, and when we went out of the country and did crusades in other countries.
How often, I mean, was it monthly that you would take one of these longer trips?
Well, out of the country, we would only go 2 to 3 times a year. And then we did 13 conferences here in the U.S. And there may have been some years where we did even more than that because we cut down some as time went by. And then I would do several speaking engagements a year.
Okay, so a different trip where you just go there and back?
Yes.
As opposed to a conference where you might stay for a few days?
Yeah, when we did our conferences, we'd be gone Thursday, Friday, Saturday. If I did a speaking engagement, I would normally just go and come back the same day.
And by the end of his employment, he was traveling with you to all these conferences?
Yes.
What did he do during the conferences?
Just made sure that everything was safe for me in the crowds, you know, when people wanted to talk to me, that it was okay, you know, that was somebody that was okay. That we have pretty large crowds. And so it was mainly just for our safety and to make sure that everything went right.
Would he travel ahead of your party to arrange things like that? Or
sometimes he went ahead of us, yes, and then sometimes he went with us.
And by 2009, at the end of his employment, do you know how much he was making?
$100,000.
She supported his story regarding the marriage counseling and how she had been the one who put the couple in touch with the pastor.
What he told me is that he felt that Sherry was very controlling, that no matter what he did, she wasn't happy, and that they just in general, you know, were not getting along, and that he was just really tired of it. And at that point, I asked him if, you know, they'd be willing to get some marriage counseling from a pastor that we have at our office. And right away, he said yes, they were willing to do that, which they did do.
Joyce felt as though, knowing the information she now knew regarding Chris's affair, a lot of his behavior she had found suspicious made sense. She recalled times when she would find him on a separate personal phone. This was unusual, as Chris had a ministry phone and no need for a second. Or so she thought. Reflecting on their work trip to Florida and how Chris stayed the extra days, she said,
Did the defendant go on a trip with you during that period of time to the state of Florida?
Yes.
Was there anything about that trip, again, something you observed directly of the defendant, that caused you now to be suspicious?
Well, he stayed there. He said he wanted to stay down there for a few days after our trip was over, after the working part of our trip was over. He said he was going to visit these friends, a girlfriend of Sherry's, after I found out that that was the girl that he'd been having the affair with. Made me kind of suspicious then as to why he stayed there.
And that was sometime during this period of time, late 2008, early 2009?
Yes, I think it was in 2009.
Okay. And was that unusual for him to stay after when you'd gone on a trip?
Yeah, and especially he was by himself, so.
Okay. And again, in retrospect, that made you wonder.
Yeah.
Okay.
Joyce also noticed a change in Chris's behavior.
About a month prior to the beginning of May, say during the month of April, I just felt like I was just noticing that he wasn't as attentive to his duties. He was forgetting things that were just not normally him. And just in general, not quite as engaged. I noticed a personal cell phone in his car one day that was being charged up. And I asked him about that because I'd never seen him with it because he had a ministry phone. That was what he carried all the time. And he just said it was a personal cell phone, and I started asking another question, and then I just thought, you know, it's really none of my business if he has a personal cell phone, so I let that go.
So. Did he, during that period of time, ever call in sick for work?
On May the 4th, he called and told me that he wasn't feeling good and asked if he could take the day off.
May the 4th, 2009?
Right.
Was that unusual for the defendant?
Yes. He was... he worked for us 11 years, so I can't swear that he never took a day off, but I didn't remember him ever calling me and saying that he didn't feel good and wanted to take off. He was just always there.
And how were you informed on May the 4th, 2009, that he wasn't coming to work that day?
He called me in the morning and asked me if he could take the day off.
Okay.
Joyce also provided clarity on the implied fear that his behavior would cause him to lose his job.
If the defendant were having an affair, if you had known that at the time, and I understand you've testified that you didn't, what effect would that have had on his employment?
If he would have been having an adulterous affair while he was still married, then it could have definitely affected his job.
Okay. Were there persons over the years that were terminated in situations like that.
We had situations where they were, yes.
And in fact, he was married during the period of time that he worked for you, married to Sherry Coleman, correct?
Yes.
Were there other persons who had adulterous affairs while married whose employment was terminated at Joyce Meyer Ministry?
Yes.
For that reason?
Yes.
Pastor Jonathan Peters, the chaplain for the Columbia Police Department, testified for the prosecution. He said, "I told Chris that his family had been killed. He was stoic, quiet." Columbia Police Captain Jerry Paul testified that he met Chris Coleman in the ambulance, and when he asked Chris what happened to his arm, Chris replied that he didn't know and then hit the gurney. When Chris's father asked him what had happened to his arm, he told him that he had injured it on the gurney. At the closing of the trial, Defense Attorney Stern told the jury that the prosecution's case was circumstantial and that there was no direct evidence that Chris Coleman committed the crimes. He said that the police focused too intently on Chris Coleman and that Detective Barlow had been too involved in the case and already made up his mind. The attorney for the state, Wrights, spoke of the alleged motive Chris had for murdering his family. His high-paying dream job was at risk. He was having an affair. He lied about his family being alive when he left, as Dr. Baden's testimony indicated all three members of the family had been killed long before he left for the gym that morning. The letters were traced back to his work computer. He had bought a can of the exact spray paint used to write horrifying messages on the wall of his family home. Mr. Wrights left the jury with the most gut-wrenching image. He told them that in the early hours of that morning in May 2009, 11-year-old Garrett and 9-year-old Gavin were asleep in their beds when a killer entered their bedrooms. He said, "They didn't wake up. They didn't scream. Of course not. Why would they? It's just Dad."
2 years after the murders of Sherry, Garrett and Gavin Coleman, the jury of 10 women and 2 men reached a verdict of guilty on all 3 counts against Chris Coleman. As the verdict was read, Chris looked towards the floor. Chris was eligible for the death sentence and waived the jury's decision on that point. This meant that it was up to presiding Judge Walton. Illinois had recently passed a bill abolishing capital punishment, and any death sentences were to be commuted. Judge Walton sentenced Chris Coleman to 3 concurrent life sentences. He said, "The horrible nature of the crime cannot be diminished. Look at the pictures of the wife and 2 kids, particularly the ones in their beds. That should be a place of safety." A sentence of death may be expedient from the standpoint of the court, but I also believe it would compound the tragedy that the family has already experienced and would make me engage in a symbolic sentence of death. Chris Coleman was then escorted from the courtroom and transferred to Graham Correctional Centre before being brought to the Pontiac Correctional Centre to serve his life sentence. One of the jurors spoke to the Pinckneyville Press and said that the turning point for the members of the jury was when they saw the dates on the photograph shared between Chris Coleman and his mistress, Tara Lintz. They were dated October 2008, and before Lintz had said the affair started. They also saw the proof that Chris had been deleting explicit images and items from his phone as he was being questioned about the deaths of his wife and children. This cost the defence the trust of the jury, who ended up returning a unanimous guilty verdict. Outside of the courtroom, Columbia Police Chief Joe Edwards called the time waiting for the verdict the longest wait of his life, and when asked about the sentence imposed, he said, "If there ever is a case where the death penalty is appropriate, this is it. There is no greater evil than murdering your wife and 2 children while they are sleeping in their beds." Members of Sherry's family spoke to the media afterwards and said that it was the worst day of the year, the anniversary of Sherry, Garrett and Gavin's death, and that the verdict assured them that their faith was correctly placed and that the truth was told and justice was served. Defense attorney Bill Margulis said that they intended to appeal the decision in the immediate future. Chris's family remained adamant in their belief that he was innocent of the crimes despite the conviction. The day before the verdict, Sherry's family had filed a wrongful death suit against Chris Coleman, Joyce and Dan Meyer, and Joyce Meyer Ministries. The following year, Joyce and Dan Meyer were removed as defendants, but the case against the ministry remained. An attorney for the family said that the ministry had a duty to warn the family about the threats Chris Coleman had received, which they did not do. The family also believed that the ministry should have told Sherry that Chris was having an affair. When announcing the civil suit, Sherry's mother, Angela DeSico, said, "If we can save one person from being abused, that would make us feel wonderful. That is our goal." Chris conducted an interview from prison the following year with 48 Hours Mystery. He said that he believed he was found guilty because of the morality of the small-town community. He indicated that the affair he had and the fact that the jury consisted of 10 women and only 2 men played a part in the decision that was made. He maintained that his family were targeted by someone with a vendetta against Joyce Meyer Ministries, and that someone else sent the threatening messages, despite them being traced to his work computer. An appeal, which asked appellant judges to consider information from the original trial to see if there was an error, was filed on December 31, 2014, raising 7 issues. 1. Whether the trial court erred in allowing the state to present the testimony of an expert linguist. 2. Whether the court erred in allowing the state to present the sexually explicit photographs of Chris Coleman and Tara Lintz. 3. Whether the court erred in allowing 5 witnesses to testify to hearsay statements attributed to Sherry Coleman regarding Chris's alleged desire to get a divorce, and that Sherry was ruining his life, and that the court denied his motion for a mistrial after one witness said that Sherry said Chris beat her. 4. Whether the court erred in admitting the testimony of Lindell Moore when he compared Chris's handwriting to the spray-painted messages. 5. Whether the court erred in admitting the testimony regarding the IP addresses linked to the emails and computers. 6. Whether the court erred in admitting the receipt from the hardware store showing spray paint was bought and allowing a witness to testify about its content. And finally, whether the evidence presented proved the defendant was guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. The Illinois court upheld the conviction, despite Chris Coleman's multiple claims of evidential error, and said that perfection in trial procedure is virtually unattainable. A defendant is entitled to a fair trial, but not necessarily a perfect trial. This did not deter Chris Coleman from appealing again and again. In 2008, he filed a post-conviction petition in an attempt to get a new trial. A post-conviction relief petition covers any violation of a defendant's constitutional rights. He stated that he had ineffective counsel, was denied due process, and he claimed actual innocence. He had already been denied a motion for a new trial and an appeal. Chris Coleman was granted an evidentiary hearing following a motion to dismiss the petition for post-conviction relief he filed in 2019. Chris had said that his constitutional right to due process was violated when the jury were given photographs with metadata such as a timestamp attached to the back. This metadata had not been specifically entered as evidence. He cited comments jurors had made about seeing the timestamps on the photograph and how that swayed their decision to find him guilty. Judge Stephen McLean found that the metadata was not extraneous and did not violate Chris's constitutional right to due process. In July of 2020, there was a hearing which granted Chris Coleman's request to represent himself in his continuing attempts at overturning the verdict that had been imposed years earlier. His post-conviction relief petition was dismissed by September 2020. Chris Coleman, who is now representing himself, wanted access to the case files in order to be better prepared to appeal yet again. There are people who believe that Chris Coleman is innocent. Some even think the serial killer Edward Wayne Edwards is responsible. The fact remains that Chris Coleman was found guilty of the murders of his 31-year-old wife Sherry, his 11-year-old son Garrett, and his 9-year-old boy Gavin. In 2012, Sherry's family won the right to relocate Sherry, Garrett, and Gavin's remains from the site their killer chose to Queen of Heaven Cemetery in Cook County, close to where Sherry's family live. Chris Coleman allegedly told Sherry that she and their children were keeping them from his destiny. The immorality of a divorce in the eyes of the evangelical community they were a part of meant that Chris Coleman needed another way to get his fresh start with his secret girlfriend. He had told Tara Lintz that he would be ending his marriage on May 5th, 2009. But he ended three lives instead.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Crime Lapse. Crime Lapse is an independent podcast that is funded in part by our generous Patreon supporters. If you enjoy the show and want to help us keep it going, you can join us on patreon.com/crimelapse. And in exchange for your pledge, you'll get access to early release ad-free episodes, bonus content, and exclusive merchandise. You can also support the show by subscribing and leaving us a 5-star review. You can keep up to date with us on social media at Crime Lapse on Instagram and Facebook, and at Crime Lapse Pod on Twitter. Stay safe.
Season 3 of Tapes from the Dark Side.
Gilchrist County 911, what's the address of the emergency?
Brings you a new tale of true crime.
Yes, ma'am. I just shot my daughter and shot all my grandkids, and I'll be sitting on my step, and then when you get here, I'm going to shoot myself.
Coming to all platforms Friday, March 26th. Available 1 week early on patreon.com/tapesfromthedarkside. The story of the Spirit Family Massacre.
I think everyone has a bit of a fascination with the dark side.